welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It is a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are currently working on. And today, I'd like to introduce you to Paul Akpomoje, who's working on a PhD in education under the supervision of Dr. Claire Ahn. Welcome to Grad Chat, Paul.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for coming. And before we dive into your research topic today, I was curious to know a little bit about what attracted you to Queen's for your graduate research in the first place?
That's a good question. I get to be asked that question oftentimes. As a matter of fact, I remember when I was applying to come to Queen's and I had the first meeting with my amiibo supervisor. That was the question she asked me. She was like, "So Paul, why are you interested in Queen's? Why do you want to come to Queen's?" I remember what I said then is what I am saying now. And that is the social justice component, you know, that the Faculty of Education has. The Faculty of Education is very, I would say, we have this set of faculty members who are very grounded in social justice research. And because I am very much interested in social justice research, I was like, it has to be Queen's and it has to be the Faculty of Education. So I would say that the social justice component of the PhD education program there, it was a big attraction.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that the original attraction has continued throughout your research and been confirmed that you made the right choice for conducting your research at the Faculty of Ed. And with that, can you tell us a little bit about what your research topic is for your PhD?
That's a really good question. Oftentimes when people ask me what your research topic is, I get sometimes confused because there are many parts to read. But just to put it as it is, it is visa stories of Nigerian immigrants in Canada and implication on their identities. But in a very lay way, I try to describe my research topic as visa stories and the poetics of migration. Because there is that synergy between those two, you know, elements. So, yeah.
Very nice. Okay, so it sounds like that could be very, very broad. It could encompass a lot. So is there like a particular community within Nigerian immigrants in Canada that you speak with or work with? Or can you tell us about a little bit about who you're working with, I guess?
Yeah, thank you so much for asking that follow-up question. I was really hopeful that you would ask because that gives me an opportunity to clarify. I'm specifically working with migrant doctoral students. And very also specifically at Queen's University.
Okay.
So my research participants are PhD students who are at Queen's, who are in their first year and above. So that's the specific group of Nigerian migrants or immigrants in Canada that I'm working with. And this is, I have a couple of reasons why I'm working with this particular group. And this is because I was drawn to those specific migration experiences that he had with respect to being in a higher education program at Queen's at a higher level, that's at the PhD level. Yeah, so that specific set of people is the group of people I'm working with.
Okay, and how do you approach that? Like, what methodology are you working with, or methodologies are you working with to learn about what the experiences of Nigerian doctoral students at Queen's and...
Yeah, that's a really lovely question, because I would say that my methodology is everything about my research. And I'm very thankful to my supervisor, Dr. Claire Ahn, who is an expert in multimodality and multiliteracies. So when I was coming to Queen's and I was thinking of, okay, what methodology do I use to do this research? I remember my supervisor and I, we had a lot of ideas and conversations about what do we do differently. I wanted to do something that I would say is different. That doesn't mean that people haven't done it, but in my own little world, I would say something different. And so what that means is that I was thinking about, okay, how do I approach this, including thinking about, oh, okay, podcast and media? What do I do? So eventually, because also I am somebody who is interested in poetry, mm-hmm. I was thinking, okay, why don't I think about a non-traditional way mm-hmm. of doing narrative research? All right, narrative research and narrative methodology, mm-hmm. I would say, is very Western-centric, mm-hmm. it's very Eurocentric. Mm-hmm. I think about the way narrative research is done across the world. Is very centered on Eurocentric ways of being and knowing, of doing research. And I was like, okay, how do I bring in African, you know, approach to this thing? And that's the orality. You know, how do we bring in that oral component of doing narrative research that also centers, you know, African voices and also centers, you know, voices that are often, you know, silenced. So that drew me to thinking about multimodality, and so the methodology that I'm using is that I use rather because I'm done with data collection.
Now. Oh, congratulations!
Yeah, and I'm still, the methodology that I used for my data collection was grounded in that multimodal, you know, approach where I was engaging with my participants with different genres. For example, we're using what I call mockumentary, pretty much like a short episodic, you know, comedy series to sort of like get them to awaken their consciousness. That's the word I'm looking for. So we use that comedy series, for example, to awaken consciousness of participants about, you know, visa experiences, about migration experiences. Then we also went on to use music. You know, we also went on to use nonfiction, like short nonfiction pieces. And I really like this particular one that I use, and I know it might be of interest to the radio audience, and that's the one by Elamine Abdemamoud.
The
Son of Elsewhere. I remember my supervisor, you know, told me, I said, Paul, have you read this book, Son of Elsewhere? I said, oh, I'd like to. And that became one of the materials that I used in my research, you know, by, you know, asking my participants to read certain pieces of that story. And what they read triggered them, you know, to begin to, you know, think about their own experience. You know, so that was also something else. And we also used poetry. And I'm so grateful to one of my mentors, that's Juliana Okot-Bitek, who's a professor in English department. I use one of her poems as well, which is There Is Something About Vancouver. That's an amazing poem. So that's another piece of poetry that I also use in my research. So these different modes, from poetry to written nonfiction to movies, that which is like a comedy series, which it's more like a mockumentary series, you know, even to use a newspaper article. So these are like different pieces of instruments that I use to awaken the consciousness of my participants. So I didn't have to do so much in terms of questioning them. They just needed to engage those pieces. And then they were like, oh my goodness, this is me. You know, they were seeing themselves in those, you know, stories.
The resonation.
Exactly. So those were some of the things. And then I went on to also do, by the way, I did all of those in workshop settings.
Specifically,
I used workshop and interviews. So all of those multimodal pieces, I use them within the workshop setting, and even the traditional, like newspaper articles and even nonfiction, those were done within workshop settings. So I invited my participants to different workshops, specifically 4 workshops. You know, they also created their own story of migrancy, and they used different modes. Some of them used music, some of them used poetry, some of them used, you know, what I call think piece, to also tell their own stories. So those were the ways I gathered my data. And then I did a one-on-one follow-up interview with the participants, you know, on one-on-one basis. Yeah, that's pretty much what I would say for now.
Oh, that is wonderful. So it sounds like, again, I'm not an education scholar, but it sounds like you infused traditional Western practices with a different epistemological approach to thinking about how to create new ways of doing things and not being bound by traditional research on narrative and looking outside of just a Western canon to see what could be done to help understand and appreciate the experiences of Nigerian PhD students, and then to allow them to also reflect and create their own new.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many things. I don't think media quite captures it, but their own artistic expressions, right, or different types of expressions of experience. Would that be fair to say?
That's close to read. But I wouldn't even say traditional Western, you know, methodology.
Okay.
What I did was to do away with the traditional
Western. Get rid of it completely. Yeah. Yes.
Was to say, because I did mention the piece about orality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, orality is a very, you know, very strong African indigenous mm-hmm. method, right? So that way people's voices are centered.
Mm-hmm.
So my approach was to, how do I center the voices of my participants?
Mm-hmm.
So how do I make the research, you know, focused or centered on the participant and not on me? Yeah, mm-hmm. right. So mm-hmm. I was sort of like decentered, and mm-hmm. the participants were centered in that research because it's their story, because
yes.
it's their lived experiences. Mm-hmm. So that's my methodology sort of put them at the center of the research,
mm-hmm.
Where they took, you know, ownership of their own voices, they took ownership mm. of, you know, the way they wanted to share or tell their stories,
mm.
and that's the important piece, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's how I would describe it.
Okay, yes. Yeah, so in a traditional Western sense, the researcher might be observing folks, whereas in yours, the participants are creating and at the center of it, and you're facilitating but not directing curate, like you're creating space for it.
I was pretty much curating that mm-hmm. space for the participants to tell their stories
mm-hmm.
and not imposing anything, and not just also observing what they are not saying and, mm-hmm. and saying that they said, you know, which is the, you know, as you said, traditional mm-hmm. Western way of reason, you know. So yeah, so mm-hmm. I curated the space for participants to tell their story. I would say it was pretty much organizing a community
mm-hmm.
for people to tell their stories.
Yeah,
and I think that's the word, because I'm using this word specifically because some of my participants did use that word.
Mm.
That your research gave us community.
Oh, that's amazing.
So that community was a very strong component
mm-hmm.
of the research, where participants, you know, felt that they had just gone through, you know, what I would call therapy.
Mm.
You know, as a matter of fact, some participants described the entire research process as therapeutic.
Wow. Yeah. So the impact is huge.
The impact is huge.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I think you've alluded to this already, but what is the impact and why is this research so crucial, especially right now in kind of this global context of restricted mobility and shifting attitudes towards migration and mobility? So why is this so important right now?
That's a great question. I don't think that the world has faced a more difficult time
mm.
when it comes to global mobility, with what is happening in the US, you know, with what is happening in some parts of Europe, with what is happening in Canada today, the mm-hmm. politicization of immigration. I would think that immigration is something that is crucial, but this is not to also lose sight of the fact that Canada is built, I don't want to say Canada is not built on migration. Canada is built on settler colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to continue to recognize the fact that people belong to this land originally. The
mm-hmm.
indigenous people belong to this land originally. And they were displaced, I would say. Many mm-hmm. of them, you know, were, you know, removed from mm-hmm. their lands. And mm-hmm. the lands were taken from them by, you know, European settlers. And I would say that we have to continue to talk about that. We have to continue to say that we have to continue to talk about decolonization.
Mm-hmm.
We have to continue to talk about all of those very important social justice movement that we have to continue to talk about. But even then, historically, Africans were also brought to this land to
mm-hmm.
build this land. And as laborers, as mm-hmm. cheap laborers, you know, maybe they were not even paid, if you like. But the point I want to bring out of this is that there is this historical, you know, element about movement and mobility,
mm.
starting from when it was, you know, people coming to grab lands that didn't belong to them, to these same people bringing in, you know, Africans to come out, you know, build
mm-hmm.
this country. That's the history we have to continue to bring to, you know, to fall
mm-hmm.
so that we can continue to. But then, when people then want to come to Canada. And I have to say this also, bringing people to Canada, like opening the borders and say, oh, migration, people come. Mm-hmm. It's definitely also, you know, a way of perpetuating certain logics, you know, logics of control, logics of, you know, wealth creation, economics and whatnot, you know. However, there is a global concern about how migration is racialized.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is the point here. How certain bodies are not allowed, you know, to go through the borders versus how it is so easy for certain bodies to go through the borders. You know, and that's the peak, you know, of my argument in terms of how do we make the migration experience to be centered on humanity rather than on the color of skin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's where my research comes in terms of how do we undo practices of migration that perpetuates harm, that perpetuates different forms, you know, of discrimination and stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's something that is crucial in this conversation. And so why my research is important is, in this sense, is that if Canada is opening its borders to migrant students to come in, how are migrant students experiencing space?
Mm-hmm.
How is this experience also informing the way they think about themselves? How is this impacting their identity? How is this shaping their, you know, their worldviews and whatnot? So I think that the research such as mine, and I would say that there are people doing, you know, other research. Mine is just unique specifically because of the methodology, the approach with which I'm doing this research. And, you know, with also with respect to the specific context, right? How do we rethink migration policies and practices in ways that are centered on decolonization, in ways that are centered on humanity, in ways that are centered on, you know, equity and, you know, social justice. And that's really the point, you know, such that people are not treated specifically on the basis of who they are. Because they identify as Black or they identify as African, they should not necessarily be, you know, mistreated, let me use that word, because of how they identify. And this is not just, I have to put this very front and forward, this is not just migration in terms of the paperwork of migration. The paperwork of migration is important. It's an important component of my research. But it's not just about the paperwork of visas, of get visas. So when I say visa stories, I don't necessarily mean, you know, the visa that is stamped on the booklet.
It's a little deeper than that.
It's a lot deeper than that.
Yes, yes.
It is visa stories that goes into space and place and, you know, experiences within different social contexts in Canada, experiences in higher education, experiences, just an experience that a person would have by just being, you know, at Kingston Center, or an experience that a person would have by being on the bus. You know, all of those experiences put together is what I have operationalized as visa stories.
Okay.
So not necessarily the paperwork of visa, which is a crucial part of it, but that is not the only, you know, angle, the only lens from which I'm looking at it. You know, so in other words, there are these different pieces that add up to the visa stories that I'm exploring.
It sounds like, again, and correct me if I'm, if correct my understanding if, if needed, but you're taking, you're looking at these long histories of migration and settlement in what is now known as Canada, and seeing how maybe logics of racial discrimination are being reproduced and re-experienced, and saying, you know, if Canada is supposed to have one idea of like a mythical idea of nationhood, where are people being excluded from that, and how can we understand experiences of, in this case specifically, Nigerian doctoral students to understand where harms are being perpetrated and how we can maybe remedy that as a nation. But understanding that it fits into this long, long story and long history of different types of migration, and understanding that it's a settler colonial foundation from which it comes from, and then pushing that to the current and seeing what that looks like now and how it's being experienced for newcomers to the area.
I wouldn't say that that historical piece is big on my work, because there's a recognition of that history of settler colonialism. And I have to say this, that the same logic of settler colonialism that, you know, that was used to grab lands from people here, which we have to continue to talk about and speak against. There's a similar logic of post-colonialism in Nigeria. There's a similar logic of post-colonial struggles that are going on, you know, in Nigeria that impels people to travel. You know, there are neo-colonial tendencies about, you know, how the economics of certain countries are controlled by global power, you know, by this, you know, global control of, you know, wealth and whatnot, you know, that continues to reproduce, you know, certain forms of hardship in those countries, you know, such as Nigeria. And people then say, okay, I have to leave to find, you know, better life for myself and my family and my kids, you know. And then one of the ways people are living is, okay, let me go and further my education somewhere. You know, so there is that connection.
There's an entanglement.
There's an entanglement, you know, there. And that doesn't also mean that, you know, the colonial, you know, experience of indigenous people here is over. It's still ongoing. It's an ongoing practice. And it's ongoing, and we have to continue to, you know, speak against it and decolonize the system. You know, so, but for specifically saying for my research is, how are those, as you said, how are those logics surfacing with new faces of discrimination, of racialization, specifically against Nigerian PhD students at Queens? And this is because this is the specific group of students that I'm working with. So yes, you're right, there is a resurface of these racialization, there is a resurface of these, you know, acts of discrimination that we have to, you know, engage.
And it sounds like, well, from the response you had from your participants in finding community, that it can really, this new methodological approach can really help people address these concerns, like address the harms and put them in context with, and put them in relation with one another and bring them together. And you said that, and you were using mockumentary and poetry and nonfiction and newspaper articles and different things to try and, bring this to the fore for people and to allow them to reflect alongside, you know, a piece of artistic work to bring out their own experiences. Correct. And that you've used poetry for this, and you use poetry outside of your academic work as well. So alongside your academic writing, you are also a poet and writing poetry. And you have, I hear, a forthcoming collection coming out on African migration. And that sounds like a lot to manage between doing working on a dissertation and working on a collection of poetry. So how did you manage the workload of these two very intense projects at once?
That's a really good question. Again, you know, in the real sense of it, a good question. Poetry for me is life. And poetry is a way of being. I would say that as a poet, and having done some poetry community events within Queens, you know, and Kingston, with special gratitude to my mentor, Dr. Catherine McKittrick, who, you know, who supported me and mentored me, you know, towards doing some of these things that I do, especially having organized the Poetics of Migration in 2024. January 2024, which was a very major poetry event in Kingston.
I do remember seeing this. Yes, exactly. It was very major.
It was a major one, right? That, you know, that we did somewhere at Pedal Works Cafe. Those were like the blocks that shaped my work. And those are like the blocks that got me thinking about what I need to do. So when I started documenting my experiences, really my forthcoming poetry book is really a memoir. That's why I describe it. It's a memoir of my own experiences of being a migrant graduate student here in, you know, at Queens. You know, if I go to class and something happens in class, I come home and I write a poem about it. If I, you know, if something happens to my kids at school, they come home, they tell me this happened, I write a poem about it. So it was like a memoir. It was a way to document. So that's why I would say it wasn't so much of a burden. I was only documenting my day-to-day experiences, you know, of my lived reality, you know, of living in Kingston and living studying at Queens and being in Canada. And incidentally, that that process shaped my research.
Mm.
Because a very big component, a very big piece of my research today is I'm turning my transcript into poetry.
Oh, very cool. Yeah.
And I probably missed that part when I was talking about
it. Yeah, no, that's really cool. Yeah.
You know, that's the analysis part of my research, where I'm turning my transcripts into poetry.
Mm.
So when people read my thesis, instead of expecting a traditional thesis, they'll first be reading poetry. And these poems came all from the transcript.
Mm.
You know, what would be described as found poems, right? So the process of doing that, the poetizing of my transcript, which in the literature is called poetic transcription, in the process of doing the poetizing of my transcript today, you know, that process has become possible because I started writing my own experiences in form of poetry some months ago, some 2 years ago. So I would say that it is complementary.
Mm.
You know, that's what I would say, that my research and my art complements each other very fittingly.
Mm.
So even though I would say that it was a bit, you know, demanding, because I cannot, I don't want to say that, that it wasn't demanding. And the reason I don't want to say it wasn't demanding is because today everybody today is a poet, because of generative AI, somebody goes on ChatGPT or goes on Gemini or whatnot, and generate a poem and say they're a poet. You know, that's why I have to, you know, acknowledge that the process of doing art and doing poetry as art is, you know, demanding, is tough. I'll give you an example. I just said now that I'm doing poetic transcription of my data and as an important step in my research, it takes me about 2 to 3 days to write a poem. Just one poem, 2 to 3 days. And I imagine for some people it would probably take more. And I can also say that I'm only saying the 2 to 3 days of crafting the poem, not the other hours afterwards that I'll go back and tweak something and refine something. So in summary, that process of doing PhD research has become immensely enriched by my own poetry art. And my own poetry art has immensely been enriched by, you know, my PhD journey. So they complement.
Yes.
It's perfectly. And I would say also that my research almost negatively affected my poetry. Because in a way, when I remember, and I can say this, when the editor of the poem, of the book, reached out to me, I was like, oh, Paul, you need to put away your academicness. I'm like, oh, you're right.
They're like, I can feel it in your poetry.
He said, but you're writing this poem for the public, not for academic. I said, you're right. So that got me to go back to my poems and began to redo them, rejig them, you know, make them public for public consumption. You know, so that's that impact. So I cannot separate both. You know, they are two sides of a coin.
Oh, well, I'm excited to see when it comes out. Are you allowed to say when it will be
available? Definitely. As I speak with you, I've just gone through the second round of the Galley proof. From what I see from the publisher, it's a Canadian-based publisher that's publishing the book, and that's Griot's Lounge Publishing. From what I see from the Galley proof, it might be out before the end of 2025.
Oh, exciting. Yeah, okay.
It might be before the end of this year. And I'm looking forward to, you know, to multiple readings, you know, here in the radio, at Queen's, in Kingston, across Canada.
Yeah, we'll have to look forward to that. And,
yes,
we'll have to, if you'd like, we'd love to have you back on Grad Chat to talk purely about your poetry, if you'd like, in the future.
yes, for sure.
And it sounds like, I mean, well, having success with this collection, you've been having success in other places as well with all of the hard work that you've been putting in. And I heard recently that you have actually been awarded an Ontario Graduate Scholarship, or OGS, as it's frequently called. But you're the first international student to hold this award in the Faculty of Ed. So what does that mean to be the first person to win an OGS award?
Yeah, to be the first international student to win OGS award in the Faculty of Education is a big deal. And this is me trying to accentuate it very clearly
mm-hmm.
that it's a big deal. But it didn't come easily because I know the effort that I put
mm-hmm.
into it with the support of my supervisor. You know, as I would always say, I have mentors who have supported me, who have helped me since I've been here at Queens. My supervisor, Dr. Cleanne, is one of them. You know, she's very supportive. She's one person that wouldn't let you just do it anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
She would say, it can be better than mm-hmm. this, you know. So that's the thing. And I love that. I love her for that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if not for her, I probably, you know, wouldn't even be here. I also have my mentor, Dr. Catherine McCartrick, who has also shaped me in very many ways
mm-hmm.
and supporting me in different ways as well in terms of jurisdiction. I have other mentors who have supported me, you know, people like Professor Juliana Okon-Bitek, you know, people like, you know, Sadika Meyer. You know, these are some people who's, you know, from whom I have drawn from,
mm-hmm.
right? So, but specifically with respect to the OGS, I have to say that I've also been immensely impacted by Dr. Grace Adeniyi Ogunyaki,
mm-hmm.
who is also a member of my committee,
mm-hmm.
and Dr. Tashika Pillay. These are like members of my committees that have really shaped my work
mm-hmm.
and shaped my thinking. I'm sure to shock you to know that the OGS that I won this year was my third attempt.
Mm.
You know,
it's a challenging process, right?
Yes. It was my third attempt.
Mm.
I did attempt it the first time,
mm-hmm.
the second time. This third time, I said I was not going to apply. I said I was not interested
mm-hmm.
because I was tired.
Mm-hmm.
But I remembered that winners don't quit and quitters don't win. So because winners don't quit and quitters don't win, I tried, you know, I drew from, you know, my mentors,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Pillay and Dr. Adeniyi Ogunyaki, and of course my supervisor leading the process, you know, with me. I drew on their feedback. I drew on what they were telling me to think about and think
mm-hmm.
through and do. And I was able to, you know, craft a proposal with the immense support of my supervisor and got the proposal ready. And then I submitted, and lo and behold, I won.
Oh, congratulations.
And I, as I said when I won that award, that it's not a victory for me. It's a victory for international students at Queens. I'm not the first international student at Queens to win it,
mm-hmm.
but I'm the first international student in the Faculty of Education
mm-hmm.
to win it. So that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also like setting the pace for other international students in the Faculty of Education not to give up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I first came, some of my friends who had applied told me, Paul, don't worry to apply, you can't win.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I believe what they said is their experience, right? But I just wanted to try because I'm not the type who gives up.
Mm-hmm.
That also helps to push back against, you know, the discrimination in the process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because to have only six, there are only six slots for international students at Queens.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
For the whole international student, about 1,000 international students would only have six slots for
mm-hmm.
OGS. So that's why it's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's not just something you just, you know, gloss over when somebody wins.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have competed for one out of six slots from 1,000 or so, you know,
mm-hmm.
applicant, right? So for me, it was a big deal because it also sort of like validates
mm-hmm.
the kind of work that I am doing.
Mm-hmm.
It also sort of like validate the kind of the approach or the way I am approaching social justice research, you know, from the point of view of migrant students,
mm-hmm.
from the point of view of, you know, racialized students, from the point of view of African students. So it validates that reality, it validates that experience. If I don't, maybe I shouldn't use the word reality because reality is contested,
mm-hmm.
but it validates the experience of my participants,
mm-hmm.
my own experience of, you know, many other, you know, African, Nigerian PhD or even master students or even undergraduate students who are here at Queens. It brings our experiences to the table. It means that somebody is beginning to pique interest
mm-hmm.
in our experiences. It means that somebody is beginning to take interest in the things, you know, that go on, you know, with that group of students.
Mm-hmm.
It means that somebody is beginning to take interest in, you know, that category of students. It means that gone are those days when our experiences are swept under the carpet. That's
mm-hmm.
what it means. But again, as, you know, it's popularly said in Kenya, it is not yet Uhuru.
Mm.
And when we say it is not yet Uhuru, we means it is not over yet.
Mm.
It means it's not victory yet. It means that we still continue. We still have to continue to push. We still have to continue to you know make advances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, until we get to the to that breakthrough where we are recognized for the work that we do,
mm-hmm.
for the things that we bring to the table, for the intellectual, you know, work that we do as graduate students, as African mm-hmm. students, as Nigerian students. But it also means that, you know, the ontology that mm-hmm. shapes our lives here at Queens and in Kingston and in Canada, it also means that, you know, that experience is there is more to it that, mm-hmm. you know, that meets the eye. So I would say this award means a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It means a lot.
No, and
I can go on and on talking about it. Yeah.
No, but it's great. It's for all those reasons that you've explained, right? It's recognition, and I'm so happy that you are able to get that and that you didn't give up in mm-hmm. in your application process, because I know scholarship applications take a lot of time, they take a lot of effort, and they take a lot of it's a lot of emotional labor, right? To put yourself out there, to be vulnerable, yeah. to share your research when it's still in process, right? Mm-hmm. When it's a very, very vulnerable thing to do. And then knowing that you could face rejection and that you have faced rejection in the past, right? Yeah. And then to do it again, right? So it's, I want to commend. Exactly. And again and again. I'm glad that you were successful this yeah. time, right? But yeah. it's a lot.
And so. That also mm-hmm. sends a message to somebody out there, you know, who might be listening to this, you know, radio program or listen to this podcast
mm-hmm.
who is about to give up. That also goes to say that don't give up.
Mm-hmm.
Don't.
No, because you don't know, right? Yeah. And this time you've been successful yeah. and
don't
I'm
give up.
Yeah, yeah.
This is me directly sending a message yes. to somebody. Don't give up.
I think yeah. a lot of graduate students need to hear that at different points yeah. throughout their journey,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. So and it's not just about winning OGS, it's also mm-hmm. about getting your proposals mm-hmm. through. It's also about, you know, applying for that, you know, job.
Mm-hmm.
It's also about just putting something out there when you feel like it's not worth it anymore.
Mm.
It's just not, you know, just don't give up.
No, it's reassuring, right? People need to hear that, and you're getting close to, you're in the writing stage, so you can bear witness that you can, it's possible, right?
It's possible to do hard things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's possible. I tell myself I can do hard things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I tell myself. You check my laptop, there's a sticker there. On my bag, there's a sticker that you can do hard things. Yeah.
It's for those days when you need the reminder, right? It yeah. needs to be right there.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Paul, thank you. It has been so wonderful to chat with you today about your research. And thank you so much for coming in and doing the show. And best of luck with the rest of the dissertation. And I look forward to seeing the collection come out either at the end of 2025 or early 2026. And hopefully you'll get to debut across campus. We'd love to hear more about it. And hopefully you'll come back on Grad Chat to share more. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.